Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. With the rise of technology and the interrelatedness of the internet, the prevailing thought has been that it doesn't matter where you live because you can work in the ether. And that's true to a degree, perhaps. Acclaimed economist Enrico Moretti, professor of economics at the University of California at Berkeley, thinks differently. He thinks that where you live matters more than ever, affects all aspects of your life, from career to finances, and that the kind of people you have over for dinner on Saturday nights is affected by that as well. He has written about this. It's called The New Geography of Jobs, and he's with us by phone from Berkeley, California right now. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
So there's a lot of talk about the growing gap between the rich and the poor in this country, the 1%, the 99%. You say that there's a broader national trend of differences, not just between people, but between communities, and that it started like 30 years ago.
That's right. I think a lot of the talk about inequality today is somewhat misplaced. A lot of inequality today has to do with geography, with where you live. Effectively, when you look at the map of America today, you don't see just one country. You see three increasingly different countries. On one end, you have cities like where I live, San Francisco, or Seattle, or Austin, Raleigh, or Boston, with a strong innovation-based economy and the labor force that is one of the most creative, productive, and best paid on the planet. At the other extreme, you have cities like Detroit or Flint, parts of Ohio too, that have been losing population and have falling salaries. And in the middle, there is the rest of the country, including Columbus, which seems undecided on which direction to take. Now, you know, America always had differences among its communities. Mm-hmm. Even in the 80s and the 90s, there were richer cities and poorer cities. But the differences were not all that large. They've been growing ever since, and they are now at the largest they've been in a century. And this has profound implications for us as a nation.
You point out that another common thread of thought has been that, you know, the big centers like San Francisco or, you know, on the East Coast or the West Coast and those big cities, they eventually would become too big for their own britches, sort of. And you're saying that's not really the case as long as they have some particular factors involved.
That's right. People have been predicting the demise of the great innovation hubs of America for decades now. The argument is that once you have cheap communication, once you can use the internet, email, Skype, cell phones, you don't really need to be in Silicon Valley to work with Silicon Valley companies. You don't really need to be in Seattle. You don't really need to be in New York or Boston or D.C. You can just leave wherever you want and then telecommute. You can have video conferencing. You can Skype in and so on. But so the prediction of this line of thought, this sort of Thomas Friedman world is flat type of view, is that these great centers would disappear. You know, they're very costly to live in. They're crowded. You can live wherever you want. But the reality is that the opposite has been occurring. These centers have been attracting a larger and larger share of jobs in high-tech, investment in high-tech, patents, and so on. And so instead of seeing a convergence across regions in the U.S. in terms of good jobs and high-tech and investment, we're actually seeing a divergence where cities that already have a lot of innovation in high-tech are attracting even more, and cities that don't have a lot of high-tech and innovation are attracting less and less.
My guest is Enrico Moretti, author of The New Geography of Jobs. He's an economics professor at the University of California, Berkeley. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You call it the Great Divergence, and you said it has its origins in the 1980s, when cities began to be defined by the level of education among their residents.
Yes. You know, 60 years ago, the key predictor of a community economic success was physical capital, machinery, infrastructure, effectively. So workers in Detroit were particularly productive and well-paid because they had access to the best machinery and the most advanced stock of capital. Today, the best predictor of a community economic success is human capital, which means education. So cities that have a lot of college graduates have been able to attract increasingly a large number of good, innovative employers. These employers come to the cities and further and increase the number of jobs for college graduates, further reinforcing their appeal for college graduates. And so it's a self-reinforcing mechanism where cities that have a lot of college graduates tend to grow in terms of good jobs and salaries. While cities that don't have a lot of college graduates tend to miss out on the growth of high-tech and innovation, and they fall further behind. It's a tipping point dynamic where strong communities become stronger and weak communities become weaker over time.
There's also the idea that just the nature of an innovative person, of an innovative mind, and that isn't necessarily someone who likes to work by themselves. There's a lot of collaboration in innovation.
Absolutely, and that's one of the key attractive features of these innovation clusters. Innovation is rarely born in isolation. Innovation always comes from the interaction of people, the exchange of ideas, the face-to-face interaction that occur either at the water cooler or at the local pub or in the community, often in very serendipitous ways. You see a growing body of economic evidence on this. And when you talk with innovators in Silicon Valley or in other innovation hubs, they always tell you it's really crucial to be around other people who are working on similar issues, even if they are your competitors. Ideas flow in a locality in ways that are often serendipitous and mysterious, but they do depend on this face-to-face interaction, which makes the place that you choose for your innovative company even more important, because you need to be near the frontier of research, near the frontier of innovation in order to remain productive and innovative.
Yeah, you mentioned that startups, people who do startups often are engineers or in any event, innovators, and they don't really fall far from the tree. They often stay very closely connected to their original, the company that they broke away from.
Yeah, that's another important factor that makes these innovation clusters attractive and make them grow faster than the rest of the country. Every time you attract an innovative company, say a Microsoft or an Apple or a Google, you don't just get those jobs in that company. You get all the other companies created by the workers who work for Apple, Google, and Microsoft, and then decide to open up their own startup. This process of reproduction, of corporate reproduction, it's responsible for a vast number of new jobs because these new startups, they tend to stay in the same locality, in the same city and community. It's not a zero-sum game where the children end up growing at the expenses of the parents. It's often the case that the children add to the richness of the local innovation cluster and ecosystem. So ultimately, this is an important engine of job growth. For example, in Seattle, I estimate that 3,000 local companies are due to former Microsoft alumni, people who joined Microsoft, worked for Microsoft for a few years, and then they left and opened up their own shop. These 3,000 additional companies create tens of thousands of new jobs in the local economy.
There's often the point made with the auto industry in Ohio and Michigan that it's not just the automaker, it's all the other suppliers that go into and that are required by the automaker. It's the same thing with ideas, right?
It's the same thing. It's actually even more important. The suppliers, not always physical supplier, but they're often suppliers of services and things like, the intellectual property lawyers and suppliers of specialized services. They are crucial for the health of a local innovation ecosystem. For the car industry, it's clear that the suppliers are very close to where the final producer of cars are. For the iTech, they're even more clustered. So the amount of clustering that you see, it's even stronger. And that is a further reason for why these clusters are why location matters. You can't survive if you are not inside the cluster because you don't have access to these services. it's yet another reason that generates these attractive and magnetic power of clusters.
Rod in Columbus, you're on the air with Enrico Moretti. Welcome to the show, Rod.
Good morning. I had a comment, a couple of questions. It's my opinion that the fact that America has declined in basic industries will hurt us in a strategic manner. Should we ever decide to go to war, basically, we'll be dependent upon other nations for steel and so forth. And I wanted to basically, my questions are, how has the decline in manufacturing affected America, and also, with the change from basically a manufacturing to service economy, how the decline in wages, manufacturing jobs paid fairly well as opposed to service jobs, how that is hurting the economy.
Yeah, these are two very important questions. In the past 30 years, we have been shedding about 370,000 blue-collar jobs per year on average, every single year. And this has been occurring both in recession times, but also in expansion. If you look at the trend of manufacturing jobs, it is a pretty flat downward sloping line. Now, the last couple of years have been better, and there's been a lot of talk about the resurgence of U.S. manufacturing. But in my view, those were that's great news, unfortunately, those were exceptional years, because they followed two very particularly bad years in the early part of the recession. The reason why I'm not very optimistic about the manufacturing jobs coming back in large numbers is that their decline is driven by two forces that are not losing strength. One is globalization, is the fact that increasingly American manufacturers are keeping here design, engineering, and R&D jobs, but they are outsourcing the production job. And the second force is automation. It's the fact that if you ever visit a factory, you see that there's nobody there anymore. It's all machines, basically. And neither of these two forces is likely to lose in strength. So looking forward, I'm not sure that the future of our labor force it's in the production of physical products. American manufacturing companies are doing fine. They're producing twice as many goods in value relative to 1980. But they're employing fewer and fewer workers, and they will keep employing fewer and fewer workers, in my view, unfortunately. Now, I think you're absolutely right that we can't just all work for an high-tech company. Not every American worker will work or would like to work for Google or for Microsoft or for a biotech startup. But this is actually where I think there's an important reason why the rise of innovation matters to all of us, and not just for workers who are employed in high-tech. When a community attracts an high-tech company, it gains more than just the jobs in that company. It gains all the local service jobs that are indirectly supported by those additional jobs. Jobs like waiters, taxi drivers, childcare workers, but also jobs like doctors and lawyers and teachers and nurses, that are all effectively supported by the wealth created in the community. And this multiplier effect is particularly large. I estimate that an high-tech position that opens up in a city supports five additional jobs in the local service sector outside high-tech. So just to give you an example, like Apple has 13,000 employees in Cupertino here in Silicon Valley, but it indirectly supports 70,000 additional positions outside Apple in the local economy, in this local service sector. And these are, as I said, it's a diverse group of positions, not always poorly paid. Sometimes they're very well paid, and sometimes they require a lot of skills. So remarkably, the most important effect that these high-tech companies have on the local economy is not for high-tech workers, it's in the local service sector. And this is why it matters for all of us, not just for those who work in high-tech.
Thanks, Rod, for the call. We're going to return to our conversation with Enrico Moretti, author of The New Geography of Jobs. When we return, this is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Jackie Leiden. Coming up in the next On Point, a look at the Obama administration's top secret battlefields, from the tribal areas of Pakistan to cyberspace. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon from 1 until 2 on 89.7 NPR News. A mix of sun and clouds today with a chance of a stray shower, just a slight chance of rain, and a high of 78 degrees. There's a slight chance of showers tonight and a low of 57. Sunshine for Friday, a nice day with a high of 82. Currently 71 degrees with partly sunny skies in downtown Columbus.
Support for 89.7 comes from OSU's John Glenn School of Public Affairs, offering continuing education and graduate degree programs designed for the working professional. More information at glenn.osu.edu.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Enrico Moretti. He's author of The New Geography of Jobs. He's an economics professor at the University of California, Berkeley. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also go to the All Sides with Dan Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. I thought it was interesting how you talked about in your book the divide and how it's beginning to affect cultural identity, health, family stability, and politics.
Yeah, I think the divergence in economic fortunes of American community is important, first and foremost, for the economics. But it also, it has become so large that it's now affecting all aspects of our lives. Let me give you a couple of examples. Health, for example, is increasingly unequal across American communities. One way in which you can measure health is, for example, longevity. If you look at the average longevity of males by county, counties that have high longevity, they like Fairfax, Virginia, or Santa Clara County here in Silicon Valley, they tend to have the average male there lives 15 years longer than the average male in counties who have low longevity, like Baltimore. So if you compare Fairfax with Baltimore, they're just 60 miles away, but the average male lives 15 years longer in Fairfax. This is a stunning difference. It's much larger than the difference in longevity that you see between the U.S. as a whole and, say, Bolivia or other less developed countries. It's almost as if we have different countries within our country. Some part of the country are advanced post-industrial society with high level of longevity, and other parts of the country are poor developing countries with low level of longevity. What's even more stunning is that these differences are growing over time. They've been growing for 30 years, and they're now the largest they've been in a century. And they reflect this increased polarization of you know, good jobs and high income in some communities and not so good jobs and low incomes in other communities. There is also divergence in divorce rates. You know, the city that has the highest divorce rate per capita is not Vegas, as you might. It's actually Flint, Michigan, and this reflects. You know, divorces are caused by many factors. I don't mean that it's all about economics, but certainly when the local economy is doing poorly, it certainly doesn't help. And again, when you look at the difference between communities with with weak economies and communities with strong economies, you see that the divorce rate, they keep diverging, they keep growing apart. Politics is the same. The if you look at how often, you know, it's obvious that our politics are very polarized, blue states and red states and so on. But it's not just who we vote for. It's also how much we vote. In some communities, people vote a lot. In other communities, very few people vote. Counties where people vote a lot, they have four times more votes per capita than counties where people don't vote a lot. It's almost as if the former group, you know, voters in those counties are given four ballots when they show up at the polls, and voters in the latter group, they're only given one ballot. Now, as you can imagine, this has profound implications for who our leaders will listen to. If you're the president or the governor, are you going to listen to the community that doesn't vote or the community where everybody votes?
So, and I'm just going to guess that the communities with higher levels of education and so forth and more higher levels of innovation are the communities that vote the most.
They do. There is some of my research points to the fact that one of the key determinants of voting is education. So more educated individuals tend to vote more and also tend to be more informed about the issues and tend to participate more in the political process outside voting. So they're more engaged in local organizations and local politics. And so communities that attract all these highly educated workers are also the communities that are most influential in the political process.
We have an email from Nick along those lines. He asks, why does your guest claim that innovators choose their place? Isn't this in conflict with the idea that innovation emerges from places with strong educational performance?
It's not in contradiction. You know, the fact that Silicon Valley has some of the most successful and creative startups and companies, it doesn't reflect the fact that the people who are born in Silicon Valley are smarter or are more creative or are more innovative. It reflects the fact that innovators from all over the world, from Ohio, from Israel, from Europe, from the rest of the world, they moved there because they found that ecosystem particularly fruitful. The same is true for the other great innovation hubs. And increasingly is also true for the talent. You know, if you visit some of these companies, you look around, it's pretty clear that a big chunk, sometimes the majority of workers around you, especially when you go to the cafeteria of this company, you see all the workers together, it's pretty clear that a lot of people are of Chinese or Indian descent. So the success of these great innovation hubs is not due to something that is just specific to that has to do with the geography or the you know, there's no silicon in Silicon Valley. It has to do with the fact that it's a lively ecosystem that keeps attracting the best companies, the best workers from all over the world. And you know, this matters because it basically sucks away talent and companies from other parts of the world.
You said that some sectors and occupations just born promise to alter the landscape dramatically. I was wondering what you're talking about there, and are you looking, is it 30 years hence you're talking about, or the more immediate future?
I'm talking about the 5 to 10 years future. The point there is that what we consider a good job today or an innovative company today, in 5 or 10 years will not necessarily remain a good job or an innovative position. The frontier of technology and innovation keeps shifting. So you can't, as a community, you can't just rely on the ecosystem that you have. You need to constantly adapt it. For example, you know, Rochester, New York, used to be one of America's great innovation hubs in the 80s and the 90s because they had Kodak and Xerox. Kodak failed to deal with the digital revolution, and they basically they used to have 50,000 employees in Rochester. Now they have less than 8,000. The community failed to reinvent itself. they in the 80s and the 90s, they had the most advanced type of productions because Kodak was one of the most innovative companies in this country. But it missed the new revolution, and the community, instead of reinventing itself, instead of leveraging its own local ecosystem in something new, it basically missed the new technological wave, and now it's losing its competitive advantage. By contrast, Silicon Valley has been able to constantly reinvent itself. It used to be mostly hardware and computers, then it turned into IT and software, and more recently has reinvented itself into digital entertainment and clean tech, nanotech, and so on. The difference between these two clusters is that their ability to remain on the frontier and to basically leverage their skills into something new every time the technological frontier evolves.
You called iPhone the poster child for globalization. There's been, iPhone, of course, has been in the news so much lately, and it was interesting. I think it was something like Apple takes back $352 or something like that for every iPhone. It actually brings that back, even though all of the manufacturing jobs are in China now.
That's right. This goes back.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. And it goes back to what we were talking about with the first caller about where are the jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Apple, you know, if you have an iPhone, you flip it around, you'll see on its back that says designed in California, assembled in China. And basically, the only jobs that remain for Apple are those in Cupertino, where the engineers and the marketers and the software developers are. The production of the physical parts of the iPhone are all in Taiwan or Singapore, and then the parts are assembled in Shenzhen, China.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, most of the value of the iPhone it goes to the Cupertino workers because making the nuts and bolts of the iPhone or even the electronic, the sophisticated electronic parts, it's so competitive these days that there's not much value added there. That you can go to a Singapore company and get all the very sophisticated electronic component made for very, very little value. Most of the value here is in the coming up with idea, with the design, with innovation. So, and that's why innovation matters. It matters for the Apple bottom line, of course, for its stockholders, but most importantly, it matters for the workers at Apple, those who are in Cupertino, who keep some of that value added in terms of higher wages and more jobs.
We have an email from Severin in Reynoldsburg. Severin writes, please ask Mr. Moretti to speak about this divergence in jobs happening within metro areas such as New York City, L.A., or certain Columbus neighborhoods where the money and innovation are clustered together and the rest of the population has to make do with low-wage jobs. Also, what advice does he have for legislators and citizens who live in cities like Columbus, which have not, in his words, made up their minds yet about what kind of economic base we want to have in the future?
Right. So the first part of the question, I think that so my research shows that if you are a non-highly educated worker in a highly educated city, you're better off than if you are a non-highly educated worker in a not-so-highly educated city. So, for example, the wage of high school graduates is much higher in cities where there's a lot of other college graduates and a lot of innovative companies than the wage of high school graduates in cities where there are fewer college graduates and not so many highly educated and not so many innovative companies. In some sense, the economy of a city is so tightly interconnected that workers that are outside high tech in some sense benefit from the wealth created inside ITAC, because a lot of those local service jobs for the less educated workers effectively depend on that wealth. through the multiplier effect in other channels. So, for example, if you are a waiter or a taxi driver or a worker in childcare, your wages tend to be higher. The higher is the fraction of workers with a college degree around you, because those are the cities where there is more innovative companies that generate more wealth that is then spent locally in these local services. So I'm not sure, you know, we talk a lot about inequality and often our political discourse, it often assumes that there is the interest of one group are against the interest of another group. And I think when we talk about job creation, that's not the case. I think that's a case where the interests of one group are, and the interests of all the groups are in a locality are all very aligned. A local economy effectively lifts all boats when it grows and sinks all boats when it declines.
And then that the advice that you might have for legislators and citizens and others who live in cities like Columbus, and you put it in your words, have not made up their mind yet about what kind of economic base they want to have in the future.
Yeah, Columbus is an interesting case. If you look at, for example, the share of college graduates in the labor force, Columbus is number 48 out of 300 metro areas in the U.S. So Columbus, it's in the top part. It's not in the very top 10, say, or top 20, is top 50, but is in the upper part of the distribution of college graduates. And it does have some high-tech, some innovative companies. It certainly has not developed a very self-sustaining, deep innovation cluster yet. The question is what to do to go there. And the key for a community, as I was hinting before, is education. It's basically having the most well-educated labor force that you can have. That's going to have tremendous benefit for the educated workers themselves and as well as for those with less education in the community.
Okay, so there's a lot of people educated every year in Columbus by virtue of Ohio State University. Huge campus, huge number of students, but there's this issue about keeping them here, old brain drain problem. We've got them here. What do you have to do to keep them nowadays?
Well, college graduates are the most mobile of all segment of the American labor force. They are the group, much more than high school graduates and much more than high school dropouts. They are the ones that are the best equipped to look for job opportunities elsewhere. And this poses enormous challenges for states like Ohio or Michigan that have world-class state university systems. But a lot of their college graduates, once they receive their degree, they tend to move to New York or San Francisco or other areas where there is more attractive jobs. And this is, this is a major challenge. There's a recent study out of the University of Michigan that shows that effectively the University of Michigan, it creates a lot of college graduates, but it doesn't add a lot of college graduates to the to the number of college graduates in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
It fails to significantly raise the number of college graduates in the state because a lot of these young people are so highly mobile. And this is another of the reasons that makes it so that increase the divergence across American communities. Michigan college graduates don't go to Detroit. They park and move to where the best job opportunities are, and this makes the Detroit local economy even, increasingly weaker. And so it's really hard for a local community to compete in that respect, unless they're able to create jobs for those college graduates. If they are, then they're going to start experiencing this self-reinforcing positive loop, where you have jobs for the college graduates, more college graduates stay, you get even more innovative companies, more college graduate stays, and so on. And you have this self-reinforcing mechanism that grows the local economy.
Enrico Moretti, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Enrico Moretti, he teaches economics at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of a new book. It's called The New Geography of Jobs. When we return, Josh Krajic. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit wosu.org/email to sign up.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and you can discover more about All Sides with Ann Fisher by visiting our website, wosu.org/allsides. On the site, you can listen and watch the show live weekdays from 10 until noon. You can also explore the archive, which includes audio and video of every show. That's wosu.org/allsides.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Noble on Long Condos, offering homeownership opportunities in the King Lincoln District, featuring a diverse community with a mix of historic and newly built homes and condos. Details at homeportohio.org/nobleonlong.
And stay with us for All Sides with Ann Fisher, Hour 2, beginning at 11 o'clock, a conversation with OSU President E. Gordon Gee. That's from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News. 71 degrees in downtown Columbus, a slight chance of rain today, otherwise a mix of sun and clouds, a high of 78. There is a slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 57. Sunshine for Friday, a beautiful day with a high of 82. And looking ahead to the weekend, sunny skies on Saturday, a high of 85. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The first judge to speak after Josh Krajic performed his audition song for The X Factor last year was, of course, Simon Cowell. But instead of his usual instant critique, Cowell just came right out and said it.
I've got to say, Josh, you know, I always thought after a few auditions over the years, I wouldn't be surprised again. And then you started singing and it just blew me away.
Krajic blew a lot of people away that night and throughout the competition, which he ended as runner-up to 19-year-old British Virgin Islands singer Melanie Amaro. Josh will be performing in Columbus for the first time since the X Factor competition tomorrow at the Newport. For more information, you can go to our website at wosu.org/allsides. He joins us in the studio right now. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
What I love about you, Josh, this was Simon Cowell again, is that you're honest. You didn't come out here with any gimmicks. Good for you. How did you prepare for the audition? And I wondered what you thought about that when he said that.
Well, I think I was glad that he kind of understood that I'm not a guy about gimmicks. You know, I just kind of am who I am. And he got that right away. So that was a bit of a relief, you know.
Melanie won the $5 million recording contract, and I was reading about how they're trying to make her lose weight and get beautified for it. Are you glad that maybe you're not in the hands of people doing those kinds of things?
Well,
not that you need to lose weight or you're not beautiful.
Sure, but I think that there's some more that goes to it when you win that could be extra stress levels, but it's really kind of hard to tell what would have happened had I won, and, you know, my feeling was with second place that I would have more freedom. But who knows, maybe I would have had the same amount of freedom creatively had I won. I just had less financial woes.
Right. So what have you been doing? You've been working on music, mm-hmm. working on a tour that's coming up this year.
Yeah, I've been mainly focused on kind of the pre-production of my record, and what that entails is basically songwriting. So I've been meeting with a lot of great songwriters in L.A. and in the U.K. and having some great sessions and just kind of trying to amass as much great material as you can. The trick with that is eventually you have to choose which one of those songs make it to your record. So that's a kind of a fun, but sort of, you know, sort of kind of a dark side of it too.
Because killing
gotta,
your babies,
yeah,
right?
You got to kill your babies off to get down to the ones that are your favorites. So, but I'm looking forward to that process too. There's a lot of great songs, but we'll get it done.
I actually listened to the audition YouTube video today, and I think it's something like 8.9 or something like that.
It's a lot.
Million.
I haven't looked in a while, yeah.
It's amazing. But I enjoyed seeing your mom. It made me, you know, smile. She was very cute. And I'm wondering about the change. Of course, it's changed your life. I'm wondering about the rest of your family, your daughter, that kind of thing. What's it been like going through all this with them?
It's an adjustment for everybody, I think. you know, my daughter, she loves the whole thing, but at the same time, it's she's a teenager, so it's kind of more like what about her at this point, not so much about her dad. So that's one thing, and everybody else just kind of has to deal with how much less available I am, and I think that's a challenge for friends and family. That's a challenge for me to stay as available as I can, even as busy as I am, you know, because I travel a lot and I'm gone a lot and different time zones, and so it's an adjustment, but it's a fun problem to have, I think, for everybody.
So you've been having fun?
Yeah, absolutely. Been in London recently, and I mean, working most of the time, you know, and the reality is you're usually in a windowless room as a songwriter, you know, you're just kind of in a basement somewhere slaving away at making the song right. But I did get a chance to get out and see part of London, and the weather was better this last time around, and had a good time. And luckily, the Olympics hadn't yet come to the city, so the traffic wasn't as bad as
or the Jubilee.
Right, or the Jubilee. That's the other thing. I got out of there just in time, so it was easy for me to get around.
Back to the songwriting, back to the music making. It's not your first record.
No. I've been making records since I knew that I was able to, you know. I think I made my first record when I was 18 or 19. And I've made a couple with my band here in Columbus with Joe Veers. He's a local engineer. He's got a great studio in Grove City. And, you know, I've made a couple in between that, too. So I've been making records. It's just, it's different now because I'm competing with a larger market than I had before. So it's
in other words, the expectations are higher.
Right. And now I'm trying to get on the radio, where before I just wanted to kind of sell records here in town and around the area. But and I still want to do that, too. But I guess it's different only in the sense that now it's a possibility that I'll be on the radio, where before it really wasn't.
We have a tweet from Jason. And by the way, listeners, if you want to tweet us, that's one of the fastest ways to get through to us at Ann Fisher WOSU. And Facebook's another good way if you want to. Josh will be with us just for a few more minutes. Tweet from Jason. He says, excited to see Josh tomorrow night. What can fans expect? New songs, cover songs, both?
Yeah, both. It's kind of a tricky part of my life right now creatively because there's the record hasn't been finished. So we don't want to give away a lot of those songs early. And you don't want to do all covers either. So it's a mix of trying to do both and making it fun. So, you know, the band's smaller than what I'm, you know, on the record. I could put strings and horns and backup singers, and I'm not yet ready to have the band that big. So it's going to be a little bit of rock and roll, more so than the record might be, and it's going to be a lot of fun. I know we've been working hard, and the band's great, and it's going to be awesome, I think.
You're splitting your time, as you mentioned, between Columbus, L.A., and London, pretty much, right?
Yeah.
And this is your first local appearance?
Yeah, actually, I did a short appearance at the Columbus Commons for this
the
Field of Dreams thing,
right?
Which was awesome because I got to meet all these legendary baseball players that I watched when I was a kid, and it's funny, they all knew, most of them knew who I was, so it was very strange.
That's a weird feeling, huh?
Very strange. Rod Carew, Hall of Famer Rod Carew, came up to me and said that he and his wife were huge fans of mine. It was unbelievable. Wade Boggs had me call his wife on his cell phone.
Well, that's the power of the X Factor. Yeah. And were you an X Factor? Well, of course, that was the first season of X Factor, but yeah. Those other kinds of competition shows?
I'd never watched them, really. I mean, here and there. I mean, because it was kind of a cultural
thing. The auditions
thing.
Are kind of fun to watch.
Yeah, I'd watch some of those. I would watch those. But I never... It's one of those things that I always said, I would never, ever, ever, ever do that. I would never do that. Oh, I've got too much integrity. That kind of thing, uh-huh. You know, young man's words. When I turned 30 and I said, what, you know, who cares about being cool? You know, for whatever reason, I thought it was uncool to go on television and make your dreams come true. But it's the best thing I ever did. So it's fun, just funny that I never really watched them. I mean, I was aware of them, but... I think the fact that the show was called The X Factor insinuated to me that it was something more than just being a singer, which is important to me.
Looking for that X Factor.
Yeah.
The thing that makes you... Enrique Iglesias, I guess, when you spoke at Nicole Scherzinger, when you sang at Nicole Scherzinger's, I didn't really get what that... I just happened to see it on YouTube this morning. But he said, yeah, he's got star power, but it's different.
Yeah.
And that kind of struck me. What did he mean by that? What do you think he meant by that?
I think he probably meant that I don't look like your typical pop star, even though I may have what it takes to be one. I'm guessing because, you know, I've got this long hair and this beard, and I think that I'm just different. And I think that he was paying me a compliment in that sense.
Someone was asking me yesterday, well, what kind of music does Josh do? I'm like,
it's kind of hard to categorize. I mean, I've played rock and roll most of my life, but I'm a soul singer. So the record that I'm making, it's going to be a soulful, honest pop record. And the trick is to not be too much of any of those things. You know, it's got to have a nice balance. It can't just be all poppy, and it can't just be all pastiche soul. You know, if you just go on there and emulate what the guys did in the 70s and 60s with the soul music, then it becomes something very drab and that you've heard before. So the trick is to make it fresh and new at the same time as paying homage to those things that I love.
Singing about the grind of the X Factor and how you had to turn things around so quickly, what was that like? And how did you keep injecting yourself into each song week after week?
Well... the trick was really not ever stopping. If you just keep going, then the stress doesn't really get...
Don't think about it too much.
Don't think about it too much. Relax at night. And so I would have a couple cocktails at night. Because I had to. Because it was just 18 hours of stress. And obviously not every night can you have a cocktail. But the nights that I could, I would. But more importantly, those 2 minutes that I would perform were the funnest part of the show. So that was easy. Getting in front of the audience was the fun part. Yeah. So the rest of it was just hard work.
Why did you pick At Last for your audition? It's sort of your signature song now, I guess.
Well, Etta James is a big influence on me. I mean, there's a song she sang called Fool That I Am. And there's a version that didn't go on the record, but I've heard. And... she sings something on there that is just so perfect. It's so perfect. And so I've always been impressed with her. And I mean, at the time when she was at Chess Records, she's 18 years old. She sounds like she's lived a life, you know.
Already.
And I know times were different than in a lot of ways. People were older at 18. But when I said I want to sing At Last to the producers or whoever it was, they said, well, Simon... he hates that song. You shouldn't do that.
Oh, that's what his remark was then. Really?
He says, he hates when people audition that. Okay. He hears it. Everybody always does it. I said, well, he's never heard me do it. So tell him I'm going to do it. Of course, they don't tell him what I'm going to sing.
In advance.
But I think that's why when I say that, you see him kind of say, really?
He kind of rolled his eyes.
Great.
And he figured someone must have told you that he hated the song.
Yeah, yeah.
And you did it anyway.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Your band will be with you tomorrow night including WOSU's own Eric French.
Mm-hmm.
And looking forward to your hometown audience again?
Absolutely. It's going to be really fun to see all those familiar faces and a lot of new ones. We haven't yet sold out. I'd like to sell out, but most importantly is just to have a lot of people there to have a great time. So tickets are still available.
Right.
On Ticketmaster and PromoWest.com. But we're really looking forward to it. It's been great being back with the band again. And it's going to be really fun to be able to play some guitar leads and get on stage. Because, you know, when on the show, 2 minutes, you're barely even warming up. You know, I'm used to playing for an hour at least. So I'm really looking forward to it.
You know, we were just talking about job outlook and with the author of a book about the geography of jobs and where people go for that creative kind of that, I guess the X factor of a town. Mm-hmm. And you must have had people trying to pull you away from Columbus at this point saying, why are you going back there? Stay in L.A., stay where the people are.
Right. Well, The reality is I've been too busy to even consider a move.
Okay.
I really like L.A., but I also really like Columbus. So it's a trade-off. I may need to go to L.A. for a year or two just for work, you know, just to make it easier to get in and out of meetings. But I don't know. I might just stay here and fly out for those meetings too. So it's a tough decision to make because here Columbus is home and it's a great city. And it's a great place to live. And the traffic isn't nearly as bad as in L.A. That's really the biggest problem.
The Outer Belt just isn't what you thought it was before.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah. Well, now it's a breeze. It's a complete breeze.
Well, thanks for taking the time to come and join us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Josh Krajicek, Columbus singer, songwriter, and runner-up for The X Factor. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.